So the connection between metaphysics and ethics is nowhere more clear or direct than where questions about the nature of the will arise. For it is all and only creatures with wills who can intelligibly be said to be subject to moral praise or blame. And it's only by understanding the metaphysics of the will that we can see why that is the case. Moreover, there may be no area where bad metaphysics has caused greater damage to moral theory and practice than where errors about the nature of the will are concerned. The most obvious and commonly cited example would be the thesis that free will is an illusion, the truth of which would undermine the very possibility of morality. But Thomas would cite other examples too, albeit ones that are bound to be more controversial. There is the voluntarist thesis that the intellect is subordinate to the will, which Thomists take to have irrationalist implications. There is the related thesis that the will's freedom consists in freedom of indifference toward the various ends it might pursue, rather than freedom for excellence, or the freedom to pursue the good, the cited distinction emphasized by Servais Pinkers. And related to that error is yet another one, according to which freedom of the will is incompatible with the theological truth, which, as I will argue, is also a philosophical truth, that the wills of the blessed in heaven are forever fixed on God, and the wills of the damned are forever fixed on evil, a truth the rejection of which is bound to have dire consequences for moral theology. These errors are rooted in more fundamental metaphysical errors. For example, there's a tendency to hypostasize the will, to treat it as if it were something like a substance in its own right, rather than a power of a rational substance. This tendency reflects a blindness to the unity of the human person that has followed upon modern philosophy's abandonment of the notion of substantial form. Modern philosophy also abandoned the notion of natural teleology, and with it any possibility of seeing the will as naturally directed toward the good. Then there is the materialist denial of the immateriality of the intellect and the will, and of the will, which is a necessary condition of the will's being free. Now, even philosophers who avoid these errors often fall into yet others. For example, they suppose that the way that an immaterial mind secures free will is by virtue of being a Cartesian res cogitans that interferes with otherwise causally determined bodily processes. Or they suppose that the will's being fixed on good or evil after death is to be reconciled with free will by adopting compatibilism. The best way to clear up such errors is to take things back to first principles and then work them forward again. The will is one of the powers of a rational substance, whether a human being or an angel, and a rational substance is, of course, a kind of substance. So it will be useful to begin by considering what it is to be a substance in general and what it is to be a power of a substance. Then we could consider what it is to be a rational substance specifically. The true nature of the will qua power of a rational substance will be revealed by this way of proceeding, which is, I think, more or less Aquinas' way. In particular, it will be evident that the intellect is prior to the will, that the will is free, and that it is naturally directed toward what the intellect perceives to be good. Other aspects of human action will also be illuminated, such as the role that the circumstances a rational substance finds itself in play in determining what is will. And it will become clear exactly how the errors I referred to arise from neglect of one or another part of the metaphysical story that I'll be telling. Okay, so that was all part one, or the introduction on this outline, by the way. So we move on to part two, substances and their powers. One way to understand what a substance is to contrast it with what it is not. A substance is not an attribute, nor an aggregate, nor an artifact. For example, redness is an attribute rather than a substance insofar as it exists only in other things, in an apple, say, or in a stop sign. Whereas a substance does not exist in another thing in the same sense. It has a kind of independence that an attribute lacks. A pile of stones is an aggregate rather than a substance insofar as it is really nothing over and above the sum of the stones that make it up, each of which would be exactly as it is whether or not it was part of the pile. A substance has a kind of unity that an aggregate lacks, insofar as it is more than the sum of its parts, each of which is what it is only relative to the whole of which it is a part. A watch is an artifact rather than a substance, insofar as its characteristic time-telling function is observer-relative, something imposed on it from outside by the designers and users of the watch. A true substance is directed toward the ends that are characteristic of it in an intrinsic way, of its very nature, rather than merely by virtue of the purposes of some artificer. That was not a dramatic pause. I just needed something to drink. The technical Aristotelian Thomistic way of capturing the difference between a true physical substance and a mere aggregate or an artifact is to say that a physical substance has qua substance, a substantial form, whereas an aggregate or an artifact has qua aggregate or artifact, a merely accidental form. The mark of a thing's having a substantial form is the presence in it of irreducible properties and causal powers. That's a criterion anyway that Eleanor Stump is suggesting. I think she's right about that. Any example is bound to be controversial, but suppose for the sake of argument that water is a true substance and thus has qua water a substantial rather than a merely accidental form. The idea would be that the properties and causal powers of water are irreducible to the properties and causal powers of hydrogen, oxygen, or a mere aggregate of hydrogen and oxygen. By contrast, the properties and causal powers of a random pile of ice cubes made out of frozen water are reducible to the aggregate of the properties and powers of the cubes that make up the pile. And the properties and causal powers of an igloo constructed of blocks of ice are reducible to the aggregate of the properties and powers of the blocks. Hence, to be a pile of ice cubes or an igloo is to have a merely accidental rather than substantial form. As these examples indicate, things with merely accidental forms presuppose the existence of things having substantial forms. You can't have random piles of ice cubes and igloos unless you first have frozen water. Hence, substances are metaphysically more fundamental than aggregates and artifacts. I brought up powers, so let's turn to those. A power is a capacity to act or operate in a certain way, such as acting on another thing so as to bring about a change in it. For example, frozen water or ice has the power to cool down the surrounding air. Now, a power is a kind of attribute, and like other attributes, it exists only in a substance rather than in a freestanding way. The power to cool down the surrounding air is a power of the ice. Strictly speaking, it is not the power to cool that cools down the air. It is the ice that cools down the air by virtue of having the power to do so. Molière famously mocked this sort of talk as tautological or informative, but it is not. Consider his example of opium, to which we can attribute a dormative power, or power to cause sleep. To attribute such a power to opium is not a tautology, as it would be a tautology to say that opium causes sleep because it causes sleep. When we attribute such a power to opium, we are saying that there is something about the opium itself that produces sleep. There is not something merely in the circumstances under which it is ingested that does so, even if the circumstances play some role. We are also saying that it is not merely something in some particular sample of opium that causes sleep, but something in opium as such that does so. Of course, this is not the most informative claim in the world. We would also like to know exactly what it is about opium that gives it this effect, and a chemist might tell us that. But it really does give us at least some information about opium. Now, as my remarks have indicated, the powers of a physical substance are grounded in its substantial form, and different kinds of substance will have different powers, as water and opium obviously do. Powers themselves differ insofar as they aim at or are directed toward different outcomes, as being cooled and being made to sleep are different outcomes. That is to say, powers have a kind of teleology. For the Aristotelian Thomistic metaphysician, then, the notion of a causal power is closely related to the notion of formal and final causality. Indeed, a causal power is a kind of link or middleman between a substance's formal and final causes, its substantial form and its teleology. Aquinas tells us that, quote, every form has some inclination following upon it, and every agent acts for the sake of an end. By the way, those are quotes from the Inerrant Fredoso translation of the Summa, I believe. That is to say, an agent or substance considered qua efficient cause will, by virtue of its distinctive form, be inclined toward and act to bring about some particular kind of end or ends. But a substance's form aims it toward those ends through its causal powers, as it were. It is no surprise, then, that the abandonment by early modern philosophers of formal and final causes was associated with an abandonment of the notion of causal powers. For post-Humean philosophy of causation, causes and effects are loose and separate, to use Hume's famous phrase, precisely because no cause has a substantial form by virtue of which it naturally aims at the production of any particular sort of effect. Hence, if a certain kind of effect B happens, in fact, always to follow from a certain cause A, that must be attributed to some law of nature extrinsic to A and B, rather than to some power intrinsic to A. This conceptual shift could hardly fail to have repercussions for how the will is conceived to relate to the agent whose will it is, and to the actions that follow upon its operation. Before we get to that, one last general point must be made about causal powers, which is that whether and how they operate depends crucially on circumstances. We must distinguish between a power and its manifestation on any particular occasion. A sample of opium has the power to cause sleep, even if it's never ingested and thus never in fact causes sleep. Even if it is ingested, it may not cause sleep if this outcome is blocked by some other causal factor. Say by your having taken a handful of amphetamines before taking the opium, as probably a few of you did because you knew I'd be speaking today. The manifestation of a causal power may depend on its operating in tandem with other causal powers and also on the absence of the operation of yet other powers. As contemporary theorists of causal powers often point out, such facts have dramatic implications for our understanding of laws of nature. It is commonly assumed that laws of nature are fundamental to physical reality, and that at least the paradigmatic examples of laws of nature operate in a strict or exceptionless way. But in fact, physical phenomena will exhibit the regularities described by a law of nature only given that certain causal powers are acting in tandem or failing to do so. And in some cases, this condition never actually holds. For example, Newton's first law tells us that if not acted upon, an object in motion has a tendency to remain in motion forever. But objects never actually do remain in motion forever because all of them always are, in fact, acted upon by other objects. Hence, the regularity described by the law never really holds. As this indicates, causal powers are actually more fundamental to physical reality than laws of nature are. A law is really just a description of how things will go if substances manifest their causal powers in such and such a way. As philosopher of science Nancy Cartwright famously put it, the laws of physics lie. Or to be more charitable, they're engaged in broad mental reservation. This is the only context where that joke would be intelligible. They do not describe physical reality as it really is, but only some idealization of physical reality. Now, determinism, as traditionally understood, essentially presupposes a picture of the world on which the laws of nature are metaphysically fundamental and causal processes are secondary, operating in a way that conforms strictly to the laws. But this has things backwards. It is substances and their powers that are fundamental, and laws are secondary, describing the patterns that will result if certain combinations of powers manifest or fail to manifest. Hence, determinism simply gets nature fundamentally wrong. And note that it is not only human beings that it gets wrong, but also non-human animals, plants, and even inanimate phenomena. Since much of the modern debate about free will presupposes this deterministic picture of nature, from an Aristotelian Thomistic point of view, that debate simply gets off on the wrong foot and is largely irrelevant to the main issues. Okay, thus ends section 2. So we move on to section 3. On rational substances specifically. So again, the behavior of non-human animals is not deterministic, though it is also not random or arbitrary in the way some events are according to what's called simple indeterminism. Yet non-human animals do not have wills, much less free will. So being non-determined but also non-random is not sufficient for having a will, free or otherwise. What more is needed? Aquinas' answer is that the will is a power of the kind of thing whose activity arises from within it in a certain way. Specifically, by way of having knowledge of the kind of which a rational substance alone is capable. To act voluntarily is to know what you are doing in the way that human beings and angels do. But it will be useful before we give an account of what a rational substance is to say something about intermediate cases. Intermediate, that is to say, between inanimate things like opium and water on the one hand and human beings and angels on the other. A living thing is distinguished from non-living things in being self-perfecting. That is to say, in addition to having powers by which it affects other things, it also has powers to complete and maintain itself as a plant does when it grows and takes in water and nutrients. In this thin sense, any living thing, including even a plant, can be said to be a kind of self-mover and thus to act by virtue of something within it. The technical way of putting this is that it exhibits immanent causality as well as transient causality. Still, a plant, like water or opium, does not know what it is doing, and thus cannot be said to act voluntarily or from will. Now, though the behavior of non-human animals is not quite voluntary either, animals are closer than plants are to possessing the crucial characteristic that makes for will in a way that is instructive. Suppose I yank a plant from the ground or tie one of its branches back so that the leaves are kept permanently in the shade. Of course, no one would regard these movements of the plant as voluntary. The plant's natural tendencies would be to sink its roots into the ground and to grow toward the light. Being contrary to its natural tendencies, the movements that I've caused in it are violent, and violent movements are ipso facto involuntary. But even when the plant does do what is natural to it, we wouldn't say that it acts voluntarily. It sinks its roots into the ground and grows toward the light, but again, we would say that even then it doesn't know what it is doing. That is why we wouldn't blame a plant for failing to sink its roots into the ground or to grow toward the light. We would judge such a failure to be the result of the plants being afflicted by some sort of damage or disease, rather than anything analogous to choice. We wouldn't say that the plant should know better, because it doesn't know anything at all, and you have to know something before you can be held responsible. Again, for Aquinas, voluntary behavior is behavior that arises from within the agent in a certain specific way. The plant's roots being yanked from the ground is a movement that does not arise from within the plant in any sense, since in my example, I am the one who makes them move that way. The plant's roots sinking into the ground is a movement that does arise from within the plant in a sense, since it results from the plant's natural self-perfected powers qua plant. However, though the power and inclination are in the plant, the end toward which the power is inclined is in no sense within the plant, and an end's being present within an agent in some way is, Aquinas holds, a necessary condition for its behavior arising from within it in the relevant sense. Now, in a non-human animal, there is a sense in which the ends toward which its powers are inclined are within it. For an animal can perceive a thing toward which it is naturally inclined, such as the food that it eats. Even before it actually eats it, the food is in the animal qua perceived. Of course, an animal can misperceive things, as when a greyhound in a race chases a fake rabbit. But that reinforces the point that it is something, in a sense, internal to the animal, namely the end as perceived or misperceived, that moves it to act. A plant, by contrast, doesn't even rise to the level of misperception, let alone perception. So unlike a plant, an animal has a kind of knowledge of the end it is pursuing. However, we still wouldn't say that an animal knows what it is doing, and thus wouldn't hold it morally responsible for what it does any more than we would hold a plant morally responsible. For while the animal knows the end that it pursues, it doesn't know that it knows it. It doesn't know the end as an end, for it does not have the concept of an end, nor indeed any concepts at all. Hence, it also lacks the concept of being a means to an end, and thus doesn't know that its action is a means to the end that it pursues, much less that other means might be possible. This lack of concepts entails a certain inflexibility in the animal's behavior. Like a plant, an animal cannot do otherwise than whatever it in fact does. If the animal is hungry and there are no countervailing circumstances present, such as a predator's being in the vicinity of the food and frightening the animal away, the animal's perception of the food will result in it trying to eat it. Because of this lack of concepts and consequent inflexibility in behavior, Aquinas says that a non-human animal acts voluntarily only in an imperfect sense. Now, a rational substance is a substance with an intellect, and to have an intellect is precisely to have the capacity to conceptualize what one knows. A human being, qua rational animal, not only knows the food that he tries to eat, but knows it as food, and as something that would be good for him to eat, given his need for nutrition. He also knows that biting into it straight away would be one possible means of eating it, and that this has certain advantages and disadvantages compared to other means, such as baking it into a pie, or turning it into applesauce, or squeezing the juice out of it and drinking it, in the case of an apple, say. Hence, when he eats an apple, he knows what he is doing in a way that opium or a plant or a non-human animal does not know what it is doing. He is able to know this because the end toward which he is inclined is within him in a more perfect way than a non-human animal's ends are within it. In particular, his having a concept of the thing toward which he is inclined entails having the form or essence of that thing in his intellect, abstracted from the matter in which that form or essence is embedded in the thing itself. For example, when he knows the apple as something that would be good to eat, the form or essence of the apple, appleness, if you will, is in his intellect, abstracted from the matter in which appleness is embedded in this or that particular apple. And for an agent to have within it the very essence of the thing toward which it is inclined is to have that end within it in a more perfect way than merely to have a perceptual representation of that end, as a non-human animal does. We have then a hierarchy of degrees to which the source of a thing's behavior is within it. Inanimate things, like frozen water and opium, have causal powers which are directed towards certain ends, for example, cooling down the surrounding air and causing sleep, respectively, but these ends are entirely external to the inanimate things themselves. Merely vegetative forms of life have powers directed toward ends internal to them, such as growth, but without any sort of knowledge of these ends. Given their inherent directedness toward an end, the powers of these animate and inanimate non-sentient substances can be thought of as appetites of a sort, but as merely natural appetites, to use the Aristotelian Thomistic jargon, insofar as they reflect a thing's natural tendencies rather than any sort of knowledge. Since a non-human animal has the ends toward which its powers are directed within it by virtue of perceptually representing them, it does have a kind of knowledge, albeit an imperfect kind. Its powers are classified as sensory appetites. A rational substance, such as a human being or an angel, has a perfect knowledge of the ends toward which its powers are directed, insofar as the very essences of those ends are within it. The ends toward which its powers are directed are within it in the most perfect possible way, and thus its activity arises from within it in the most perfect possible way. It possesses a kind of causal power which we can classify as rational appetite. To have a will is, for Aquinas, precisely to have rational appetite, to have in the most perfect way possible the source of one's activity within one. Having a will thus entails being a rational substance, and to be a rational substance entails having a will, because every kind of substance has its own distinctive causal powers, and a will just is the kind of appetite or power characteristic of a rational substance. Notice that having a will also entails immateriality, but that the reason has nothing to do with a Cartesian res cogitans throwing a monkey wrench into otherwise deterministic material processes. It has to do instead with possessing forms abstracted from matter. Non-human animals do this in a loose sense, which is why Aquinas is willing to say that there is an imperfect sense in which they act voluntarily. For example, when such an animal sees an apple, the redness, roundness, etc. of the apple are captured in its visual experience, whereas the interior of the apple and its weight, solidity, etc., are not captured. By capturing the former without the latter, the animal's visual experience involves a kind of dematerialization, as it were. It pulls the form's redness, roundness, etc., from the apple so that they exist as the qualia of conscious experience rather than the apple itself, while leaving behind the rest of the apple, as it were. But this is not a strict dematerialization, any more than it is the dematerialization accomplished by a photorealistic still-life painting of the apple, which also captures the color, shape, etc., without capturing the interior of the apple or its weight and solidity. For just as the painting is itself embodied in canvas and paint, which are material, so too is the perceptual experience embodied in physiological activity, which is also material. By contrast, the forms or essences abstracted by the intellect of a rational animal are immaterial in a strict sense, because they are universal rather than particular, and material things are always particular. Now, the immateriality of the intellect is a large topic calling for a treatment of its own. Suffice it for present purposes to say that its immateriality is by no means incidental to the nature of the will that is the distinctive power of a rational substance. As we will see later on, it has dramatic implications for the nature of the will. Okay, so that's section 3. Now we move on to section 4, against voluntarism. If there are any Scotists out there in the audience who might want to... And Occamites, oh! Doors over there. Okay. What has been said already should make it clear why, for Aquinas, the intellect is prior to the will. For the will is a power of a substance, and a power is ontologically less fundamental than the substance of which it is the power. And the kind of substance of which it is a power is a rational or intellectual substance. Hence, the will is posterior to the intellect in just the way that the power to cause sleep is posterior to opium, or the power to sink roots into the ground is posterior to a plant. To say that the will is prior to the intellect is like saying that a plant's power to sink roots is prior to its vegetative nature. It just gets things the wrong way around, putting the volitional cart before the intellective horse. But more can be said. As Aquinas argues, the object of the intellect is more perfect than the object of the will. For something is more perfect the more actuality it has, and less perfect the more potentiality it has. And something is more actual the more immaterial it is, and more potential the more material it is. Obviously, those are controversial claims, but I'm presupposing a more general background to Thomistic metaphysics. Now, the object of the will is some concrete particular thing, such as a particular apple you might wish to eat. But the object of the intellect is the abstract essence of the thing, such as the appleness of the apple, in my example. And essences qua universal are immaterial, whereas the concrete particular apple is material. Given the greater perfection of its objects, then, the intellect is itself more perfect than the will. That's one argument Aquinas gives. A further argument is that the intellect more perfectly assimilates its object to itself than the will does. Again, when the intellect knows the apple, its appleness, or very essence, is in the intellect. But when the will desires the apple and its essence alike remain external to the will. The fundamental point, though, in favor of the priority of the intellect, is that a thing cannot be willed unless it is known, and it is the intellect that knows. An appetite is an appetite for some object, and if the object is not known intellectually, then the appetite would be a natural appetite or a sensory appetite rather than a rational appetite, and thus it wouldn't be a will. By contrast, if per impossibility, an intellectual substance lacked a will and therefore were not inclined toward or away from what it knows, it would still know what it knows. But doesn't even Aquinas allow that there is a sense in which the will can move the intellect? He does, but when properly understood, this does not in any way conflict with what I've been saying. For the will cannot move the intellect any more than it can do anything else unless the intellect first judges such a movement as good and worthy of pursuit. For example, suppose we say that the will moves the intellect to attend to some truth. That is precisely because the intellect judges such attention to be worth pursuing, and the will simply follows its lead. When we speak of the will doing this or that, it is easy to fall into the trap of thinking of the will as if it had a mind of its own, which somehow competes with the intellect. In fact, the only mind the will has is the intellect itself. When the will moves the intellect, it is really the intellect moving the intellect by means of the will. Or, better still, it is the rational substance moving itself by means of the same power by which it moves other things, namely the will. To think that the will somehow moves the intellect on its own is like thinking that when I pull a rug out from under myself and fall down, it is the rug that knocked me down. In fact, I knock myself down by means of pulling the rug. And in the same way, I move my intellect myself when I will either to attend or not to attend to some truth. Voluntarism is thus facilitated by a fallacy of hypostasization, of thinking of the will as if it were a substance in its own right, as opposed to being a power of a substance. To speak of the will doing this or that is like speaking of the power of opium causing sleep. Properly understood, it is really just a shorthand for speaking of what a substance is doing. It is the opium that causes sleep by virtue of its dormitive power, and it is a rational substance as a whole to which the will's activity is properly attributed. It is not really my will that does anything. I do things by virtue of having a will. I would suggest that the abandonment of the notion of substantial form has facilitated this fallacious tendency to hypostasize the will. If we think of the human person not as a unity, but rather as an aggregate of parts, then the intellect, the will, our various bodily parts, and the other aspects of human nature come to seem like quasi-substances in their own right, interacting like billiard balls knocking into one another. We end up with a model of human action on which the intellect directing the will to pick up an apple is conceptualized on analogy with the cue ball knocking the eight ball into a third billiard ball. Before you know it, we start wondering whether it might not really be the eight ball that's knocking into the cue ball. But this whole model is a travesty. Strictly speaking, there's just one agent here, the human being himself, who picks up the apple by virtue of knowing it and willing to acquire what it knows. There are other motivations for voluntarism, perhaps the most important one being the idea that love, especially love of God, is nobler than knowledge, and that love is an act of the will rather than of the intellect. The first thing to say in response to this is that, strictly speaking, it is, again, really the human being rather than his will who loves, and that he cannot love anything, including God, unless he first, in some sense, knows intellectually the object of his love. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about the will here in the first place, but rather a mere natural appetite or a sensory appetite. Furthermore, love has as its fulfillment the actual possession of the beloved. And without this, it is the source of unhappiness rather than happiness, as anyone knows who has ever experienced unrequited love. Hence, our supreme happiness consists not merely in the love of God, but in the actual possession of him in the beatific vision. And such possession is an act of the intellect rather than of the will. Having said that, Aquinas acknowledges that there is a sense in which the will, with respect to its love of God, is superior to the intellect. For one thing can be greater than another in some particular respect, even if it is not greater, full stop. Aquinas gives the example of a lion, which is in absolute terms inferior to a human being, but superior to a human being with respect to physical strength. Similarly, though the intellect is superior to the will in absolute terms, the will has an advantage with respect to our relation to God. The reason is that while it is better to know something than to will it when the thing willed is inferior to oneself, the reverse is the case where the thing willed is superior to oneself. For example, it is better to know a stone than to will it, because the essence of the stone, considered as a universal abstracted by the intellect from matter, is superior to that essence qua instantiated in the individual material stone. However, the essence of God, as grasped by the intellect, certainly in this life and prior to the beatific vision, is inferior to the divine essence as it is in God himself. Hence, to will the latter is superior to having the former in the intellect. Okay, that's section 4. So we move on now to section 5, freedom of choice. Modern discussions of free will often identify two conditions, one or both of which are taken to be necessary and sufficient for an agent's acting freely. First, that the agent is the source of his own actions, and second, that the agent could have acted otherwise than he does. As Tobias Hoffman and Peter Furlong note in a recent article, Aquinas also takes these two conditions to be necessary and sufficient for free choice, but doesn't regard them as independent. As I've said, for Aquinas, to have a will is to be the source of one's own activity in the fullest possible way, which entails acting from intellectual knowledge, as opposed to acting from natural appetite or from mere sensory knowledge. And that is also, in his view, what it is to have freedom of choice. The ability to do otherwise is a byproduct of this. We'll come back to that, but let's begin by noting that what freedom does not entail is the will's utter indifference to the ends toward which it might aim. Like every other substance, a rational substance is of its nature directed towards some ultimate end, and that end is its happiness, which is the realization of what is good for it. Qua rational, this substance is capable of knowing this end intellectually, and the will or rational appetite is aimed at this end as grasped by the intellect. A will that was not of its nature directed toward what the intellect takes to be good would be like an acorn that was not of its nature directed toward becoming an oak. The latter just wouldn't really be an acorn, and the former just wouldn't really be a will. We have a kind of necessity here, which Aquinas calls natural necessity, since it has to do with what a thing cannot not do, given its nature or essence. This contrasts with what he calls the necessity of coercion, which has to do with a thing's being forced to do what is contrary to its natural tendencies, as when I imagine tying a plant's branches back so that its leaves were kept in the shade. Obviously, necessity of coercion is incompatible with freedom of choice, since it would involve forcing a rational substance to do something contrary to what its intellect takes to be good, and thus contrary to what it wills. But natural necessity is not contrary to freedom of choice. On the contrary, just as you might say that a plant is more free if I do not tie its branches back, that is to say, if I let it do what it, quote, wants to do, what it cannot help aiming to do, given the kind of thing it is, so too a will is more free if it is not prevented from doing what it cannot help doing, given the kind of thing it is, namely pursuing what the intellect takes to be good. A tree that did not aim at getting its branches toward the sun would not be a freer tree, but just a defective one. And a will that did not aim at the good would not be a freer will, but just a defective will. Now, Aquinas distinguishes a third kind of necessity, which perhaps somewhat confusingly he calls necessity of the end. The reference here is not to the ultimate end, which is, as I've said, happiness, the realization of what is in fact good for a rational substance. It is rather to what is perceived to be good, or to the means by which the good might be attained. Now, the intellect can be mistaken about what is in fact good, or it might note that several different means to attaining what it takes to be good are possible. In that sense, it is not necessitated toward the ends that it pursues. Necessity of the end, in the present sense, would exist if the intellect had such a penetrating grasp of what is in fact good that it could not perceive it to be good, or if there were no possible means of attaining the good other than the one that the intellect takes to be a means. In this sort of situation, the will cannot will otherwise. Now, importantly for Aquinas, this kind of necessity, like natural necessity, is not contrary to the will's nature and not contrary to freedom. This is why I say that for Aquinas, ability to do otherwise is a byproduct of acting from intellectual knowledge, where, I would argue, The latter is what you might call the essence of freedom, and the former, ability to do otherwise, is a property or proper accident of acting from intellectual knowledge. Basic idea is that knowing things intellectually entails bringing them under concepts, and there are different ways that the same things can be conceptualized. As Elizabeth Anscombe notes in a slightly different context, quote, "A man may know that he is doing a thing under one description and not under another," unquote. And there are always alternative possible descriptions under which we might know a thing or an action. John Haldane writes, quote, "To think of an item is always to think of it via some conception. For any naturally individuated object or property, there are indefinitely many non-equivalent ways of thinking about it. That is to say, the structure of the conceptual order, which is expressed in judgments and actions, is richer and more abstract than that of the natural order," unquote. Or if I can borrow one more set of phrases, this time from Wilfred Sellers by way of John McDowell, "The idea is that the intellect always brings things into the logical space of reasons, of which the conceptual order is a part, and that space is wider than the space of causes into which our behavior and the objects we interact with also fall. Hence, since the intellect can in principle conceptualize or describe things in different ways, and thus, depending on the conceptualization or description, judge the very same things either as good a good end or as the best means, or judge instead that some other end or means is better, it follows that the agent could in principle either will or not will the same end or means. Thus, he has the ability to do otherwise just as a consequence of having an intellect. Non-human animals and inanimate things lack this ability to do otherwise precisely because they do not bring things under concepts and therefore don't have alternative ways of conceptualizing things and the flexibility of action that that entails." Excuse me. Now, this gives us a way to understand the role of circumstances in choice and action. Recall that I said that whether and how the causal powers of a substance will manifest depends crucially on context, and in particular, on which of the causal powers of other things are either manifesting or not manifesting. This, you will recall, is why it is a mistake to think of laws of nature as the fundamental level of physical reality. Laws of nature are instead a description of the way things go if there obtains a typically idealized situation in which substances and their powers are operating in tandem in a certain specific way. Hence, determinism, which presupposes that laws of nature are fundamental and describe the way things always actually go, just gets nature wrong. However, that does not entail that there is no necessitation in nature. On the contrary, though the idealized situation described by a law may not in fact obtain, if it obtains, then things really will go the way that the law says they will. That is why it is possible to discover at least idealized laws of nature. But though this is true of the order of inanimate things and of plants and non-human animals, it is not true of rational substances like human beings. For the context in which our causal powers operate does not include merely the other substances together with their powers with which we may interact. It also includes the way we actually conceptualize all this other context. And again, there are always alternative ways we might conceptualize it. Whatever particular conceptualization we adopt is part of what governs how we act. But because there is nothing in the intellect as such that entails that one conceptualization rather than another will prevail, there is nothing that necessitates a particular outcome, the way that a certain outcome will be necessitated when non-human physical substances and their powers interact in just the right way. This is why there are not and cannot be laws of human action, the way that there are laws of physics and chemistry. That the conceptual order outstrips the natural order forbids that. This is the thesis of the anomalism of the mental, famously argued for by Donald Davidson, though he did not do so in the Aristotelian Thomistic way that I've been doing. He was, I would say, essentially reinventing the Aristotelian Thomistic wheel, perhaps under the influence of Anscombe's book Intention. A conclusion that Davidson does not draw from this, but should have, as Thomists like Haldane do, is that the conceptual order and the intellect in which it resides are immaterial. For given the different ways in which the same physical facts might be conceptualized, the entirety of the physical facts is insufficient to determine or fix the content of the conceptual facts. But as I've said, the immateriality of the intellect is a topic that would need a separate treatment of its own. Suffice it for present purposes to note that the way that the intellect and will relate to bodily behavior is not by virtue of being an eccentric set of efficient causes that in some mysterious way interact with physiological processes. Consider the action of my typing up an academic paper. That my intellect conceptualizes what I am doing in just that particular way is the formal cause of the action. The end or goal of typing up the paper toward which my will is directed is the final cause. And the relevant bodily processes are the material and efficient causes. I am a single substance of which these four irreducibly different factors, some of them corporeal and some incorporeal, are aspects. It is an error, and certainly at best a tendentious assumption that the Aristotelian Thomistic philosopher would reject, to suppose that all of this must somehow be replaceable by a description couched in terms acceptable to the philosophical naturalist. Now, Aquinas offers an argument for the reality of free choice. It goes like this, quote, "Man has free choice. Otherwise, deliberations, exhortations, precepts, prohibitions, rewards, and punishments would make no sense," unquote. Now, you might think that what he is doing here is really just giving an argument for why it would be horrible if free choice were an illusion, insofar as the basic presupposition of morality and related practices would in that case be undermined. And you may go on to point out that this doesn't really show that free choice is real, but merely gives a motivation for wanting it to be real. But I don't think that that is Aquinas' argument at all. I think that what he is saying is that it is simply a datum that our practices of deliberating, exhorting, and so forth do in fact make sense. If anyone doubted this, I imagine that in response, he might offer a retortion argument to the effect that such doubt is, on analysis, incoherent, that one has actually to engage in deliberation and the like precisely in the act of trying to justify one's denial of it. It amounts to a kind of pragmatic self-contradiction, which I would argue is ultimately a kind of reductio ad absurdum argument. It's something I develop in my... I'm not trying to sell books, but since I mentioned it, I'll continue. In Aristotle's Revenge, I get into this style of argument. That's kind of a side issue. Now, this datum makes sense only on the assumption that we have free choice. If this datum makes sense only on the assumption that we have free choice, then Aquinas concludes we must have free choice. Aquinas elaborates on the point as follows, quote, "Now a man acts by judgment, since through his cognitive power he judges that something should be pursued or avoided. But the reason why he acts by free judgment and is able to go in alternative ways is that in the case of a particular action, this judgment arises from a comparison made by reason and not from natural instinct. For with respect to contingent matters, reason has an openness with respect to opposites, as is clear from dialectical syllogisms and rhetorical persuasions. But particular actions are contingent matters, and so with respect to them, the judgment of reason is related to different alternatives and is not determined to just one. Accordingly, by the very fact that he is rational, man must have free choice," unquote. Aquinas's reference to reason's, quote, "openness with respect to opposites," unquote, and to its being, quote, "related to different alternatives and not determined to just one," unquote, is, I would suggest, an appeal precisely to the slack that I have said holds between the conceptual order on the one hand and the order of things conceptualized on the other, between the space of reasons and the space of causes, to use Sellars' language. For there to be such slack just is what it is for choice to be free. Because the intellect is not necessitated to conceptualizing things one way rather than the other, the will is not necessitated to one end rather than another. But neither is choice random or arbitrary, the way it would be if simple indeterminism were true. For choice is always for a reason, even if the reason is not necessitated. And to act for a reason is precisely not to act randomly or arbitrarily. Okay, that's section 5. Now we turn to the final section, and appropriate for its being the final section, it's on the postmortem fixity of the will. When I was typing this up, I accidentally typed postmodern fixity of the will. That's a whole other talk. The postmortem fixity of the will. So this brings us at last to the thesis that the wills of the saved and the damned are perpetually fixed on good or evil, respectively, which entails a qualification of what I've been saying about the possibility of conceptualizing things differently. Let's first consider why the will is fixed after death, in Aquinas' view anyway, and then return later to the question of how this can be reconciled with freedom. It will be useful to begin by considering Aquinas' account of the way in which an angel is either saved or damned. Like us, angels choose what they choose under the guise of the good. That is to say, because they take it to be good in some way. And as with us, an angel's ultimate good is in fact God. But, again like us, angels can come to be mistaken about what that ultimate good is. An angel can erroneously take something other than God to be its ultimate good. However, the nature of this error in the case of an angel is somewhat different from the nature of the error that we might commit. In us, a sudden and fleeting passion might distract us from what is truly good and lead us to pursue something else instead. But passions are essentially corporeal. They exist only in creatures which, like us, have bodies. Angels do not have bodies, so passions play no role in leading them into error. A second way we can be led into error is through the influence of a bad habit, which pulls us away from what is truly good for us in a more serious way than a fleeting passion might. For Aquinas, there is habituation in angels, as there is in us. However, there is a difference. In our case, several appetites pull us in different directions because of our corporeal or bodily nature. Because we are rational animals, our will is directed at what the intellect takes to be good. But because we are rational animals, we also have appetites which move us toward the pursuit of other sub-intellectual things, such as food, sexual intercourse, and so forth. These appetites compete for dominance, as it were, which is why in a human being, even a deeply ingrained habit can be overcome if a competing appetite is strong enough to counter it. Angels are not like us because they are incorporeal. They're not like this because they're incorporeal. They have only a single appetite, the will, as directed toward what the intellect takes to be good. There is no competing appetite that can pull the angel away from this end once the will is directed toward it. Once the will is so directed, habituation follows immediately and unchangeably because of the lack of any other appetite that might pull an angel in some different direction. A third way that we can be led into error is intellectually, by virtue of simply being factually mistaken about what is in fact good for us. Here too, angels can make the same sort of error, but here too, the nature of the error is different in their case. The way we come to know things is discursively. We gather evidence, weigh it, reason from premises to conclusion, and so on. All of this follows upon our corporeality, the way that we rely on sensory experiences of particular things in order to begin the process of working up to general conclusions, the way we make use of mental imagery as an aid to thought, and so on. Error creeps in because passion or habituation interferes with the proper functioning of these cognitive processes, or because we get the facts wrong somewhere in the premises that we reason from, or the like. Further inquiry can correct the error. There's nothing like this in angels. For Aquinas, an angel knows what it knows, not discursively, but immediately. It doesn't reason from first principles to conclusions, for example, but knows the first principles and what follows from them all at once, in a single act. Now, because there is no cognitive process by which an angel knows, as there is in us, there is no correction of a cognitive process that has gone wrong, either by gathering new information, resisting passions, or overcoming bad habits. If an angel goes wrong at all, it is not, as we are, merely moving in an erroneous direction, but where the trajectory might be reversed. It simply is wrong and stays wrong. For Aquinas, then, an angel's basic orientation is set immediately after its creation. It either rightly takes God for its ultimate end, or wrongly takes something less than God for its ultimate end. If the former, then it is forever locked on to beatitude, and if the latter, it is forever locked on to unhappiness. There is no contrary appetite that can move it away from what it is habituated to, and no cognitive process that can be redirected. The angel that chooses wrongly is thus fallen or damned, and not even God can change that any more than he can make a round square, for such change is simply metaphysically impossible insofar as it is contrary to the very nature of an angelic intellect. Again, human beings are different because they are corporeal. Or to be more precise, they are different while they are corporeal. For a human being has both corporeal and incorporeal faculties. When the body goes, the corporeal faculties go with it. But the incorporeal faculties, intellect and will, the same faculties that an angel has, carry on, and the human being persists as an incomplete substance. This brings us to Aquinas' treatment of the changeability or lack thereof of the human will. Prior to death, it is always possible for the human will to correct course for the reasons described above. A passion inclining one to evil can be overcome. A bad habit can be counteracted by a contrary appetite. new knowledge might be acquired, which an erroneous judgment can be revised. Hence, at any time before death, there is at least some hope that damnation can be avoided. But after death, Aquinas argues, things are different. At death, the soul is separated from the body, a separation which involves the intellect and will, which were never corporeal faculties in the first place, carrying on without the corporeal faculties that influence their operation during life. In effect, the soul now operates, in all relevant respects, the way that an angelic intellect does. Just as an angel, immediately after its creation, either takes God as its ultimate end or something less than God as its ultimate end, so too does the disembodied human soul make the same choice immediately upon death. And just as the angel's choice is irreversible, given that the corporeal preconditions of a change are absent, so too is the newly disembodied soul's choice irreversible, and for the same reason. The corporeal preconditions of a change of orientation toward an ultimate good, which were present in life, are now gone. Hence, the soul which opts for God as its ultimate end is locked on to that end forever, and the soul which opts instead for something less than God is locked on to that forever. The former soul, therefore, enjoys eternal beatitude. The latter suffers eternal separation from God or damnation. The only way a change could be made is if the soul could come to judge something else instead as a higher end or good than what it has opted for. But it cannot do so. Being disembodied, it lacks any passions that could sway it away from this choice. It also, like an angel, now lacks any competing appetite which might pull its will away from the end that it has chosen. Thus, it is immediately habituated to aiming toward whatever, following death, it opted for as its highest end or good, whether God or something less than God. Nor is there any new knowledge which might change its course, since now lacking sensation and imagination and everything that goes with them, does not know discursively, but rather in an all-at-once way, as an angel does. There is no longer any cognitive process whose direction might be corrected. But might not the resurrection of the body restore the possibility of a course correction? Aquinas answers in the negative. The nature of the resurrection body is necessarily tailored to the nature of the soul to which it is conjoined, and that soul is now locked on to whatever end it opted for upon death. The soul prior to death was capable of change in its basic orientation only because it came into existence with its body and thus never had a chance to set, as it were. Once it does set, nothing can alter its orientation again. An analogy might help. Consider wet clay, which is being molded into a pot. As long as it remains wet, it can alter its basic shape. Once it is dried in the furnace, though, it is locked into the shape it had while in the furnace. Putting it in water once again wouldn't somehow make it malleable again. Indeed, the water would be forced to conform itself to the shape of the pot rather than vice versa. The soul is like that. While together with the body during life, it is like the wet clay. Death locks it into one basic orientation or another, just as the furnace locks the clay into a certain definite shape. The restoration of the body cannot change its basic orientation again any more than wetting down a pot or filling with water can make it malleable again. Now, what choice is a soul likely to make immediately upon death? Obviously, the passions and appetites that dominated it in life are bound to push it very strongly in one direction or another. For example, a person who at the end of his life is strongly habituated to loving God above all things is very unlikely in his first choice upon death to regard something other than God as his ultimate end or goal. A person who at the end of his life is strongly habituated to hating God is very unlikely in his first choice upon death to regard God as his ultimate end or goal. A person who at the end of his life is strongly habituated to regarding some specific thing other than God as his ultimate good, money, sex, political power, etc., is very likely in his first choice upon death to regard precisely that thing as his ultimate good or end. It is very likely, then, that these various souls will be locked on forever to whatever it was they were habituated to valuing above all things during life on earth. To return to my pottery analogy, the passions and appetites are like heat applied to wet clay. The longer the soul is pushed or not pushed by a passion or appetite in a certain direction, the more difficult it is to reorient the soul, just as it is more difficult to alter the shape of wet clay the longer heat is applied and the drier the clay gets. Now, the fixity of angelic wills and the fixity after death of the human will are, in Aquinas' view, consistent with free choice. Remember that, in Aquinas' view, an action's being voluntary is consistent with what he calls necessity of the end, which involves factors such as the intellect's being unable not to perceive something to be good, or there being only one possible means to attain some good. If I simply cannot possibly get across the room except by moving through space, no teleportation, sorry, or cannot possibly get myself to doubt that one and one make two, it doesn't follow that my walking across the room and affirming that one and one make two are not really freely chosen acts. The acts of angels and of souls after death are like this in Aquinas' view. They can't help either seeing that God is the highest good or failing to see this, and thus cannot help either loving God above all things or failing to do so. But, and here is the crucial point, there is nothing either external to them or in their own natures that necessitated this outcome. No one and no thing outside them coerced them into either final beatitude or impenitence. But nothing in their nature as rational substances necessitated either outcome either. They could have chosen either and ended up choosing one rather than the other. Nor was this some random or arbitrary outcome, since, again, they made whatever final choice they made for a reason. Recall that I suggested that on Aquinas' account, the essence of freedom is the agent's being the source of his own activity in the fullest possible way, and that ability to do otherwise is something like a property or proper accident that flows from this essence, rather than itself being the essence. This, I propose, gives us one way to understand Aquinas' view that freedom is consistent with the fixity of the will after death. An angel and the soul after death remains the source of its own activity in the fullest possible way, and thus remains free, even if in the most crucial choice, the choice of ultimate end, it no longer has the ability to choose otherwise. And we might think of the ability to choose otherwise with respect to one's ultimate end as a proper accident of the kind that has only a provisional status, like a butterfly's caterpillar stage. A butterfly, given its nature or essence, will necessarily manifest caterpillar attributes, but only provisionally. And an angel or human soul, given its nature or essence, will necessarily manifest the ability to choose otherwise with respect to its ultimate end, but also only provisionally. Now, one might wonder whether this position amounts to a compatibilist theory of free will. Anthony Kenny, in his book on Aquinas on Mind, suggests interpreting Aquinas as a compatibilist, though for somewhat different reasons. Now, I would answer that it most certainly does not entail Aquinas as a compatibilist. For one thing, compatibilism holds that freedom is consistent with determinism. And I've already explained why the Aristotelian Thomistic position regards determinism as a wrong-headed conception of the natural world. So reconciling freedom with determinism is simply not the sort of project that a thinker like Aquinas has in view. For another thing, precisely because of its determinism, compatibilism makes something outside the agent, namely the laws of nature together with the state of the universe prior to the agent's existence, the source of his activity. That conflicts with what I've said is Aquinas' account of the essence of free choice. Is Aquinas' view of free choice libertarian, then, to pick the other main option discussed in contemporary discussions of free will? As Eleanor Stump notes, this depends on how one understands libertarianism. If libertarian free will is taken to entail the ability to do otherwise without qualification, for example, without a qualification that would make free choice consistent with the will's fixity after death, then Aquinas' account is not libertarian. But Stump seems to think that a view according to which it is sufficient for freedom that an action originate in the intellect and will of the agent could reasonably be construed as a version of libertarianism, and on this construal, Aquinas' account would be libertarian. Perhaps the issue is, at the end of the day, semantic. I would simply point out that participants on all sides of the contemporary debate about free will, compatibilism, and libertarianism usually make philosophical assumptions that Aquinas would reject. Hence, it is not easy to situate Aquinas' position within that debate, and trying to do so can threaten to obscure his position as much as it might illuminate it. Okay, and with that, I will end, and maybe we can pick up some of these issues in the Q&A. So I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Fazer. So you mentioned in your section on the post-mortem fixity of the will, you alluded to some post-mortem choice on the part of the separated soul.
I knew this was going to come up.
So. And I know you've alluded to this in several of your blog posts about this too, so I suspect that choice is a considered commitment of yours. So I'm
it's
wondering...
A, it's a... It's a one half to two thirds baked commitment.
Okay.
Of mine.
Right. So I'm wondering where you find warrant in textual warrant in Aquinas for such a choice, and how you reconcile there being such a choice with what I take to be the church's dogmatic commitment that probation ends with death and not with any choice after death, no matter how soon after death.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Right. I'd have to go. I haven't looked at the relevant sections of the Summa Contra Gentilis, which is where most of this, I think, is to be found. So I can't cite for you exactly. And I know that, at least to some extent, my thinking on this has been formed by Garrigou Lagrange as much as by Aquinas on that specific issue. So Garrigou's got, I think the book's called Eternal Life. I can't remember. Oh, no, Life Everlasting, I think, is the book. And he gets into this, and I think he sort of tentatively paints that sort of picture of what's going on. But exactly how to, you'll notice the way I phrased it was the will's choice upon death, right? And that was intentionally ambiguous, right? But the reason it's in, because, of course, you could read that as either immediately upon after death or upon death. Now, the reason I don't develop that further is because I don't need to for the specific purposes of this paper. Does it raise theological issues? Yeah, absolutely it does, and I think those are important ones. The way I phrased it the way I did, though, and the way I developed it as I did, was just to sort of elucidate the mechanism by which Aquinas seems to think that the will is fixed on one end or another after death. But how to work that out in detail is both metaphysically tricky and theologically tricky. So I fully concede that. But I wasn't engaged in writing a paper on damnation or salvation, but rather on free will. So the reason I brought all that up was just to spell out how Aquinas' view that that the will is fixed after death is not necessarily incompatible with freedom of choice. So that's why I didn't bother to develop that further. And if I were treating that issue, yes, I'd have to say a lot more, both by way of citing texts from Aquinas and also whatever Aquinas says, how you'd reconcile this with the dogmatic teachings of the church on the subject. So fair question, but for another paper.
Thank you. I wanted to take us back to the argument for why the will has to be free, because Aquinas makes this argument in multiple places that, well, the intellect can view things under different aspects, and so it's kind of indeterminate, and somehow this is supposed to ground the will's freedom. But frankly, I've never seen how this is supposed to work, so maybe you can help me. So, because it just seems like it's kind of irrelevant, right? Like, in order to determine whether the will is free, we need to know what, as you say, actually, as you say at a few points, right, that under any given set of circumstances, that set of circumstances doesn't determine how I'm going to conceptualize the object. But that's not shown by the mere fact that the intellect can conceptualize the object differently, right? Like, that's just something that's asserted as far as I can see. So how would you respond to that?
Well, what is it you're saying is just asserted? Because I would say it's of the, when you understand the nature of intellect properly, and of course I'm a card carrying unreconstructed manualist Thomist, so I'm going to give the standard Thomist account of what the intellect involves. I know that's controversial, but if we're thinking of what the intellect is from an Aristotelian Thomistic perspective, as opposed to a modern naturalist perspective of some kind, some sort of materialist philosophy of mind, then I would say that this, what I referred to in the paper as the slack between the conceptual order on the one hand and the natural order on the other, is just a necessary byproduct of the nature of intellect. And given that slack, slack between the space of what I call the space of reasons and the space of causes, there's not going to be any necessitation, as it were, to how the intellect might conceptualize its ends, and therefore no necessitation. Regarding what the will might will. That's not the case of a non-human animal or a plant, say, because those things are sub-intellectual. And so there's no slack there between a conceptual order and the natural order, because there's no conceptual order in the first place. So it's that idea that things can always be conceptualized in different ways. There's nothing in the nature of an intellect, certainly a finite intellect like a human intellect, that determines that the intellect will conceptualize things in way A rather than way B. As opposed to, say, a dog, which, given the nature of a dog, and it's it sees the Alpo in front of it, and it's there's nothing blocking its way, and there's no predator in its way. It's necessary. It's going to pursue that dog food, right? So it's the nature of intellectual knowledge as opposed to merely perceptual knowledge that's the source of the lack of determinacy.
I mean, it's necessary that the dog do that in a given set of circumstances,
right,
a maximally
right.
determined set of circumstances.
Right.
But it's not clear to me why the same thing couldn't be true of the intellect. Like, I mean, if you consider the dog's capacities apart from some particular maximally concrete set of circumstances, then you would say it's kind of indeterminate, you know, like depends on inputs and...
What I'm saying is that given all the circumstances, the accent there is on the word all, given all the circumstances, not only its powers, but the circumstances under which they're operating and the fact that the powers are properly functioning and all that, there's no other outcome that could follow in the case of the dog. But that's not the case. If we're talking about, for example, all the physical facts, right, that there are in the context of human choice, all of that's consistent with choice B rather than choice A being made. Why? Because all of that's consistent with the circumstances being conceptualized in way B rather than way A. So as I keep saying, that it's the nature of the intellect, and it's the nature of the intellect qua immaterial, I think, because the immateriality that the aspect of immateriality that's relevant here is the distinction between a universal versus a particular. We always bring things under universal concepts, but there are always different concepts we might bring them under. That's what's doing the real work here, I think, for Aquinas.
I totally get the idea that we can conceptualize it differently. We have different concepts. It's just that it seems like it's always seemed to be like the additional causal claim about the causal slack just doesn't seem to me to follow from that. But maybe I'm just missing something. And I probably should.
Well, I mean, so spelling that out would get us into arguments for the immateriality of the intellect. And to state them in sort of modern analytic philosophy terms, which I do in a couple places, and James Ross does this, and John Haldane does this, the issue has to do with what analytic philosophers like to call the indeterminacy of meaning, or the indeterminacy of semantic content, that there's no set of material facts that can determine. And here I'm using determine not in the freedom versus determinism sense, so it gets confusing for that reason. But there's nothing in the... There's nothing in the physical facts that can fix or determine any set of semantic facts about the content of a thought or the content of the utterance of a sentence, say, or the speak or the writing of a sentence or what have you. But there's a conceptual slack there that we can be established totally apart from anything we say about free will. So I guess you would say the complete defense of what I'm saying about the free will, about the issue of free will, depends upon a complete defense of what I would say about the immateriality of the intellect, which is...
Even that assumes there's no immaterial mechanism that we don't know about, right? Like, how do I know...
I think in the relevant sense of mechanism, immaterial mechanism in this context is incoherent. Okay. It's a category mistake, I would say. So, I mean, we normally think about, when we think of a mechanism, we're thinking about some kind of physical process, something corporeal, right? Whether it's in an inanimate object or an animal or a plant or a human being, for that matter. Like digestion, you know, the mechanisms by which digestion works, the mechanisms by which vision works and so forth. And there's nothing like that going on in the case of intellectual activity. I would say of course, the word mechanism is used in a lot of ways, so we can loosely speak of mechanisms, but I would say that there's an equivocation going on there that when it's sorted out would show that the mechanisms by which the dog is fixed on eating the Alpo, there's nothing analogous to that going on in the case of the human being who conceptualizes an end one way rather than the other. But again, that gets us into philosophy of mind rather than...
Can we move on to another... I just want to make a little observation that might be helpful. Thank you, Ed, first for your talk. It got lots of wheels spinning in my head. I just want to, I think, underline it's important for us to remember that terminology of free will is really the product of the birth of modern English, or Middle English, at the time when the SCOTUS were in charge of things at Oxford. So free will is trying to translate liberum from beach will. And if you look closely at the Latin, will does not appear in that expression. So English has a interpretation of a Latin phrase embedded in it, which is not helpful.
Yeah.
So to such an extent that we can say free will does not exist in the entire corpus of Aquinas. There is no
right.
free will in Aquinas because
right.
the notion doesn't exist. Aquinas says liberum arbitrium, which is translated properly as free arbitration. It's a term from civil law that's been put into the human agency. It's someone who had the ability to make decisions about their own life publicly, a citizen in full standing, has liberum arbitrium. That's put into human psychology. And Aquinas describes it as a faculty of intellect and will. And as you notice, Aquinas affirms that it's not the intellect that acts, it's not the will that acts, it's supposits that act, it's the person who acts, and therefore it's not the will that's free, it's not the intellect that's free. I'm free because of these two spiritual powers of intellect and will, because one has agency on the level of formal causality and the other on efficient causality, and because of that relationship, I can be free. I think that's
right.
The getting rid of the terminology and going back to the old Latin expression, I think, could help us avoid already stepping onto the terrain of the Scotist, who've got a leg up on us because they've embedded it into the language.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct, and that's why, at least in the text of my talk and here on my little outline, you'll notice that I confine myself to the expression free choice or freedom of choice rather than freedom of the will. In the Q&A here, I may have slipped into, you know, I picked up this bad habit, I guess, from the SCOTUS. Blame the SCOTUS. But yes, you're absolutely right. And so I didn't get into that particular issue just because I wanted to avoid translational issues and terminological issues as far as I could. And so I tried to finesse it just by speaking of free choice rather than freedom of the will. Though it's very difficult to avoid slipping into that language because it's, as you say, it's just become part of the common coin in which these issues are discussed.
I think we have time for just one more question. Oh, Thomas Joseph.
Well, I just have a comment, and it's actually just to go back to the first question about the immutability of the soul separated from the body. I do believe that Aquinas in Summa Contra Gentiles suggests that the moral status of the soul is determined while we still have life in the body, and therefore there isn't, as it were, suggested by him in any overt way, the possibility of a new act of repentance or of refusal that would change or alter the state in which the person dies. However, I think as Gary Gulagrange notes, Cardinal Cajetan did speculate about the possibility of a new first act after death, which is very interesting just because, for those of you who like assigning things to camps and may have sometimes your categories have become too simple, it's interesting that this theory has been rehabilitated by Hans Urs von Balthasar. So you have the idea that the soul who is in mortal sin dies, but in a kind of new act of offering of grace could make a new choice, or the soul who dies in a state of grace could, in a moment of, I don't know, strange new life as a separated soul, make a new decision to abandon what had previously been its sort of stronghold in grace. And there's a lot of criticism of that view in Thomist tradition, but it seems that, as Gary Gu points out, Sylvester Ferrara posited a theory, which is not in Aquinas per se, but is a plausible, I mean, it's at least worth considering, that the soul does determine its status before God in its mutable state in the body prior to death, and that determination is what it goes before God with. However, there has to be some way in which this translates into a new ontological state for the separated soul, so that if the soul is now separated from the body, what had previously been determined through its relationship to God in grace or not prior to death is then going to be sealed in a certain way through a new kind of will in the separated state. So there is a possibility of some ontological change in which the final end of the soul for one thing or another is determined after death, even though what it is determined for precedes it and takes place in this life. So, I mean, these are, I think, some subtle questions that need to be maybe rehabilitated and thought about. But I do think the Church tends in its doctrinal tradition to emphasize that the judgment of God is based on the way the soul has conducted its life, the human being has conducted its life as an soul, an embodied person, and prior to death. So that's just worth thinking about from the side of the dogmatic apparatus.
I guess I just want to say that when I heard you mention both Cajetan and Garrigou, I had hope for a special dispensation. And then when I heard Baltasar, my hope, my heart sank.
Dare you hope?
dare I hope? So yeah, thank you for that comment, Father. And so I just reiterate that those are very important and difficult questions. And so my exposition was just motivated by the desire to present as clear a presentation of the metaphysics, but for other purposes of showing how Aquinas' account is reconcilable to free will. But yes, nowhere near an adequate treatment of this subject in its own right. All right, so thank you.